Well, good evening and welcome to you. Great that you're able to be here. Just one thing I want to remind you of is that in 3 weekends' time, it's the life course weekend if you'd like to come. It's always the thing that people enjoy most on the course. The dates are the 6th to the 8th of March, and we'd be grateful if you could start consider whether you'd like to come. Your leaders can give you all the information you'd ever need to know about the course. I'd like to recommend this book. This is The Case for Christ, and this is actually worth reading. It's by Lee Strobel, an investigative journalist with the Chicago Tribune, who did a deal with his wife that they would never, ever have anything to do with organized religion. She became a Christian, breaching the deal. He set out to disprove the whole thing, and this is the book he wrote, The Case for Christ, which you might be interested in. Jolly good. So, I've been going back to the first series of 24, and for that reason I'm going to say this. So far on the life course. We've considered the meanings that we attribute to our lives, the role of science, atheism, religion in defining whether there is an ultimate meaning or not. Last week I introduced the Christian claim that meaning has come as near as breathing, as close as hands and feet, that God has disclosed himself in the person of his son, Jesus of Nazareth. Here we discover a person who is clearly human and yet who appears to be above all human greatness. And I suggest that it might take more than a Jesus to invent a Jesus such as his uniqueness and ask the question, if God were to reveal himself, would he not look quite a lot like Jesus of Nazareth? If you were unable to be here last week, you might like to think about downloading that presentation and consider that question for yourself. Tonight, though, we're asking the entirely reasonable question, is there any evidence that Jesus is more than a man, that he is, as he says, the way, the truth, and the life? If God did reveal himself through Jesus, we are entitled to be able to identify convincing proof that this actually took place. It would be ridiculous for God to reveal himself and not let anybody know about it, wouldn't it? And it would be equally ridiculous for God to reveal himself but do it in a wholly unconvincing manner. So where's the proof of this claim? Last week we considered the character of Jesus, and we could spend hours discussing the quality of his life. Friend and foe alike admire him. He appears to have displayed a perfect balance in character, authoritative on the one hand but kind on the other, powerful on the one hand yet humble on the other. However, throughout history, as we well know, there have been people who've displayed astonishing character. There have been many human heroes, as we've mentioned before. Jesus was obviously an exceptional person, but his character alone doesn't necessarily make him anything more than a man, does it? And we could also spend hours discussing the miraculous things Jesus that have been attributed to him, that Jesus is supposed to have done. The reality is that thousands of people flocked to hear Jesus. He moved from town to town, saw it as his role to go from one town in Israel to the other, and to proclaim a message which he considered to be the message of the nearness of God, the kingdom of God, and to demonstrate it with power. And the truth is, whenever he turned up, people would flock to hear him in their thousands. And I don't think they were doing that to watch him dance or sing. I think it's because they'd heard or maybe seen for themselves that he healed people. I think it's because they'd heard or seen for himself that he could walk on water or calm a storm or feed 5,000 people from bits of bread and fish. And they wanted to see more. Who wouldn't? And yet other people in history have claimed to do miracles. And such claims are notoriously difficult to prove one way or the other. And surely Jesus' so-called miracles, like those of other people, could perhaps have a rational explanation. So the claim that Jesus performed miracles taken by itself doesn't necessarily make Jesus anything more than a man, does it? We could also spend hours discussing the claims Jesus made about himself. A cursory flick through the four lives of Jesus, the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, reveal that Jesus clearly believed he was more than a man. On a number of occasions, he forgave sins because he felt like it. The only person that forgave sins in his culture was God. To forgive sins is to say, hello, I am God here. It's a divine prerogative. He said that to see him was to see God. Whatever people did, they did to God. And that those who believed in him would gain eternal life. That he was the only way to God. That he and God were one and the same. What kind of person makes those claims? Well, actually, other people have made these sorts of claims. And most of them have been clinically insane. Making himself out to be equal with God in and of itself doesn't necessarily make Jesus anything more than a man, does it? So if there is convincing proof that Jesus personifies the meaning of life, where's the proof? Well, from the time that Christian faith first exploded upon the scene, and these kinds of claims about Jesus were first made, Jesus' disciples have always pointed to something very specific as the demonstration that he is God the Son. And that is something that they call the resurrection. So not what Jesus said, not what he did or didn't do, what was said or said about him, but to the claim that he was raised from the dead having been crucified. Indeed, twice in one of the earliest New Testament documents, Paul's letter to the Corinthian church, written, as I said, about 25 years after Jesus' death, the early church leader Paul makes this point emphatically. He says, if Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless, and so is your faith. He goes on to say, if Christ has not been raised, your faith is futile. It's futile. It's as much use as makeup on a bull, as a hedgehog in a condom factory, and one-legged man in an ass-kicking contest. It's futile, it's useless, it's Miley Cyrus. It's a waste of time, because if the resurrection didn't happen, there's no proof that Jesus was anything other than a good man. And so, in the grand scheme of things, if Jesus was not raised from the dead, it doesn't matter what he did or what he said. You take it or leave him. It's up to you. Dr. Tim Keller, one of whose books I think I recommended, the American Christian writer, put it like this. If Jesus rose from the dead, then we have to accept everything he says. If he didn't rise from the dead, then why worry about anything he says? The issue on which everything hangs is not whether or not you like his teaching, but whether or not he rose from the dead. So the question is, where's the proof? And the first Christians were convinced that 3 days after Jesus died on the cross, having been buried in a tomb, he was raised from the dead and revealed himself to hundreds of people on a number of different occasions over a period of a few weeks. Paul, again in 1 Corinthians, records an early list of people who claim to have seen the risen Christ. He says, I pass on to you as of first importance, I receive what I pass on to you as of first importance, that Christ died according to the scripture, that he was buried and raised on the third day according to the scripture, that he appeared to Peter, then to the 12 disciples. After that, he appeared to more than 500 brothers at the same time, many of whom are still living, though some have died. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles, and last of all, he appeared to me also. So where is the proof? What I'm going to do now is draw attention to some facts of history, and I will obviously interpret them in my way, but I'll be interested to see how you interpret them. So the first thing we have to consider is the fact that Jesus' body was not in its tomb 3 days after his death. The body of Jesus was placed in a garden tomb after his death. That is a fact accepted by a friend or foe alike, and the tomb was then empty 3 days later. Roman and Jewish sources confirm this. The report of the early tomb and the description we have fits well with what we know about Near Eastern burial customs and has never been challenged by enemies or critics of Christianity. Furthermore, if people are saying that somebody has been raised from the dead, and that is the linchpin of their argument, if you have the body in your possession, there is a simple way of discrediting said claim, isn't there? You get the body out of the tomb, you fling it down in the marketplace, and you say, there's your risen Jesus. Now, having gone to enormous lengths and no little amount of trouble to ensure that Jesus was actually both arrested and killed by the Roman authorities, I can tell you now that those in power would have taken great delight in crushing the fledgling faith and the proclamations on the streets and the very places where Jesus had been, causing all the embarrassment and the difficulty that Jesus caused. They would have taken great delight in going and showing the body, if they got the body, but they didn't have the body because the tomb was empty. They say that the disciples came and stole the body, which again indirectly confirms that the tomb was empty. So that requires us to believe that a ragtag gaggle of assorted disciples, women, tax collectors, various other bits and bobs, overpowered trained representatives of the most powerful army in the world stationed at the tomb. Now, the disciples had actually already shown themselves to be cowards at Jesus' arrest. They ran away and left him to his fate. Why would they choose to risk their lives afterwards by somehow overcoming a military force and stealing his body? And also, if the disciples stole the body, why did they invent a resurrection? They knew it wasn't true. Falsely claiming a resurrection meant one thing and one thing only for them for the rest of their life, which was endless persecution and a whole world of trouble. So any argument against the resurrection has to account for the empty tomb. We also have to account for the transformation in the disciples. Like the empty tomb, this is a substantiated fact. The book of Acts, which is the history of the early church, written by Luke, describes the dramatic and enduring transformation of 11 men from terrified, defeated cowards after Jesus' crucifixion into courageous preachers of the gospel of Jesus. These men became bold enough to proclaim Jesus and his resurrection despite furious hostility on the part of Jews and Romans alike, to the point of torture and death. The same men ran for their lives, denying that they'd even known Jesus following his initial arrest, and this makes the unflinching courage in the face of persecution and execution even more astounding. They attribute their strength of conviction to direct personal encounters with the resurrected Christ. They do not talk about what they believe. But what they say is, we have to talk about what we've seen and heard. We have to tell you what we've seen and heard. That's not a faith claim. It's a claim to have had an encounter. Now, you could say, and some people have suggested this on the course, well, the disciples probably did this because they felt guilty. They let him down, they felt bad, and so they kind of created something and went with it. But let me ask you, do you think that people genuinely die for things they don't believe in? We know you can get a Tibetan Buddhist monk who pours petrol on himself as a protest, sets himself on fire, an IRA hunger strike, a hunger strikes himself to death, a Japanese kamikaze pilot that bombs, you know, that dive bombs his plane into an American warship. They believe, don't they? They believe in the various things that they give their lives for. It's ridiculous to suggest that people give their life for something they know isn't true. Surely what unites people who are actually willing to give their life for something is that they believe in the cause, whether you believe in the cause or not. If the disciples made the resurrection up, they knew without any shadow of a doubt that it was a lie. Now, you might be interested to know, you can drop it in at a dinner party next time you're there. On 187 occasions in the New Testament, Christians are taught about the importance of the truth, including the claim that Jesus is the truth and that we should tell the truth under all circumstances. It's just very difficult for me to believe the whole thing is based on some huge whopper. Luke, who wrote the Gospel of Luke, is one of those guys who likes to get things right, and he's dealing with Mark's account of Herod. And Mark has called him a king, and Luke knows he's not a king, he's a tetrarch. And so he has to say that, no, he's a tetrarch. Now, is the kind of guy who's going to go to that piddling level of detail, who actually gives us the book of Acts, which contains all kinds of other detail about archaeology, military movements, geography, politics, all of which check out, actually, with contemporary sources. Is that the kind of guy that's going to invent an enormous whopper like the resurrection? It's just a question. I don't think it's likely that people will die for something which they absolutely fabricated. According to the disciples, they didn't die for a cause or a faith. They were willing to give their life not for a cause or a faith, but because of a series of real encounters with Jesus after his death, which were as shocking to them as anybody else. One of the people we often identify with most in the Gospels is Thomas, Doubting Thomas, patron saint of our age. So basically, Thomas is not there for one resurrection appearance, which happens to everybody else. He's gone to buy milk or something. And so basically, he's off down the shop getting the milk, and he's not there. So he comes back, and they're all going, he's alive! And basically, Thomas is going, no, he's not. Of course he's not alive. He's dead. We all saw him die. Unless I put my fingers in the marks, I'm believing nothing. Anyway, so basically, he pops back up again, Jesus. And Thomas says, my Lord and my God, as you would. So basically, these people who didn't believe, what are you supposed to do if the risen Jesus appears to you several times? It is this and nothing else that changed them, I would suggest, and gave them this strength of conviction. So we have to explain the transformation of real people whose direct accounts of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection we can still read for ourselves, which raises the question, what of the so-called post-crucifixion appearances? According to the New Testament, 500 people plus had real encounters with Jesus. Can I just clarify, with no disrespect to half the people in this room, when they say 500 men, they mean 500 people who could bear legal witness to something that happened. So they don't count the women. Goodness knows how many other people were there, but 500 legal witnesses were there, including a lot of other women too. They had real encounters with Jesus, the person they knew, after they'd seen him die. Witnesses of the resurrection claim to have seen, heard, and touched the resurrected Christ, even eaten fish with him. And these appearances in our time-space continuum were reported pretty much straight away after the moment they were reported, as opposed to generations later when we mythologize a happy ending to the Jesus story. You can demonstrate very easily that these claims were made almost instantaneously and were reported straight away. So it's not just 12 disciples in a conspiracy theory. It's lots and lots and lots of people. Well, if they saw a real person, then maybe Jesus didn't actually die. And yet, Roman executioners were extremely good at killing people. In fact, they were under threat of death themselves if they didn't do the job properly. Of all the things we'd like to know about history, bizarrely, one of the things that's come down to us is a lot of material about just how, what would happen to every member of a guard if a prisoner they're guarding gets away, or if they don't kill them properly. It's awful. It's absolutely awful. The idea they didn't kill him is ridiculous. In fact, not many people advance the argument that Jesus wasn't dead these days, because before he was killed, he was flogged. Now, that means that you're flayed to such an extent that your lower intestines are exposed. It's a way of killing you quickly on the cross. So he's pretty much dead before he's crucified. Then, after he's got through all that, John recalls that somebody stabs him in the side with a spear and notes that blood and water flow out of the wound. Now, John couldn't have known this, but we know that's a medical sign of death, because those two systems are not obviously supposed to flow together. When they do, you're dead. It's worth remembering again, it's a dinner party. Then, depends what party you go to, of course. Then, basically, after that, the custom was to mummify the person, you know, tie them up in strips of linen, and then pour tons and tons of perfume on the body, and then put them in an airtight tomb. Now, how do you think Jesus is going to convince these people that he's the Lord of life? What's he going to do? He's not even going to be able to get free just to start with, imagining he's not dead. And then basically, if he is, he stood no chance of even standing up without the kind of extensive medical treatments that simply weren't available in those days. Of course, he was dead. Just saying. Also, is there anything in Jesus' life and teaching to date to suggest that he would suddenly start behaving like a charlatan? Okay, so what if the resurrection appearances were hallucinations? Those who thought they saw the resurrected Jesus were actually suffering from a delusion of some kind. Well, the women who first visited the tomb and who were the first resurrection witnesses, even though women could not bear legal witness, were in a state that could be described as susceptible to hallucination because they were grieving. But they are actually the only ones. Hallucinations are induced, I'm sure you have personal experience, by such things as drugs, sleep, drink, and food deprivation, and sometimes by a highly volatile state of mind. They're also private and subjective, and they project what is already on the mind. Now, on the rare occasions when Jesus spoke about his resurrection, his disciples couldn't make sense of what he was saying. In fact, his disciples rarely made sense of what he was saying. They weren't expecting his resurrection. They weren't expecting his death. What they thought was going to happen was they were going to come into Jerusalem with the power player of the time, who had huge power, huge charisma, huge crowds, huge popularity, was obviously going to become king of the Jews, just like David, and he chose a donkey to come in, which means he is a king coming into the holy city. It could only mean one thing, that they, having had to spend years slumming it with no particular place to stay and having to be dependent on the generosity of a few other people maybe and not quite knowing where the next meal was coming from, were going to come into power with him. As James and John, known as the Sons of Thunder, said through their mother, when he comes into his glory in Jerusalem, can my children sit at your right and your left hand? That's what they thought was going to happen. What they didn't think was going to happen was he was going to be arrested and then killed. Hence the running away bit. So I don't really think the hope of the resurrection was likely to have been on their minds. And if it wasn't likely to be on their minds, it wouldn't have been likely to be hallucinated. And we're talking about everybody hallucinating the same thing at the same time. 500 men and lots of women hallucinating the same thing. That doesn't happen. Hallucinations are subjective. If you think you're Tinky Winky, I'm much more likely to think I'm the Easter Bunny. And we're talking about a significant number of people, not a handful. The resurrected Jesus supposedly appeared to 500 people all at once on one occasion. That's a lot of people. Which brings us to the final question: how do we explain the emergence of the Christian church? Another uncontested fact of history. After 400 years, Christianity came to dominate the Roman Empire and then on to shape Western civilization. Christianity developed a distinct cultural and theological identity apart from traditional Judaism almost immediately. For example, worshipped on a Sunday because that was the day of the resurrection. Jews had their Sabbath on the Friday, Saturday. According to the New Testament, the Christian faith came into being directly because of the resurrection of Jesus. According to the New Testament, the apostles turned the world upside down with the truth of the resurrection, and the extraordinarily enduring Christian church emerged based on the resurrection. How could so many people living in the heart of conservative Judaism, where all the evidence against the resurrection would have been, had there been any, come to propagate a lie? What gain was it for them to do so? How did this new faith convince so many people so quickly? Now, here are some of the reasons presented at speed, but at leisure in this book. This is quite interesting because he interviews the leading experts in the various fields that the questions of the resurrection touch on, and he asks all the most difficult questions. If you really want to get your mind around it, this is the one to do. But I have very briefly rushed through some of the main reasons why rational people have come to the conclusion that the resurrection actually happened. The tomb was empty. It stretches credulity, in my opinion, to accept the disciples died for something they knew to be a lie. Something clearly did change them. The church started not in the Galilean backwater, but in Jerusalem, where everyone saw him die. I have to say, that's a very quick thing to say, but historically this makes a lot of sense to me. When there have been revolutionary movements, they normally start in the heartland of the revolutionary. Jesus was from Galilee. The disciples were from Galilee. It's a backward province where lots of revolution had happened. In the year of Jesus' birth, 100 people were crucified in Galilee. It's always been a political turmoil. So if this is going to start, it's going to start in Galilee. It's not going to start in Jerusalem, because that's where he died. The entire city went outside the city wall to see the famous man killed. Now, if your thing is all about how he's been dead but he's alive, you're not really going to start it there, are you? Because everybody saw him die. See what I'm saying? And yet that's exactly where it started. And it's not like the proclamation of the sort of fearless and unstoppable disciples make is actually about love or, you know, putting yourself second or being a servant to the world. That's not what they say. It's about Jesus Christ, Son of God, demonstrated by his resurrection from the dead. So what do you make of this? The claim that meaning has been revealed in the person of Jesus stands or falls on the resurrection. In my experience, people often dismiss Christian belief as being entirely irrational. They think it's been made up, that it's no historical or intellectual basis whatsoever, and that therefore, by extension, Christians who actually believe it are naive. They've wittingly or unwittingly believed in a fairy tale. You know, scientists, as we saw earlier on in the course, they proceed on the basis of evidence, and they work on hypotheses based on the evidence of things they can demonstrate by experiment. Historians draw conclusions based on evidence too, evidence of sources and events. So, for example, it's long been argued that the resurrection and the supernatural elements of the story of Jesus came later than the real historical Jesus. But it's easy to demonstrate that's not the case, because in Jerusalem in the 1950s, they found funeral urns which go back to within 2 to 5 years of Jesus' life, which attest to belief in the resurrection. So what that means is the resurrection belief is close to the actual person, not the other way around. You see what I'm saying? So, I mean, you can advance these theories because it's comfortable for people. They do not want to believe in the age of electric light bulbs there can be such a thing as a resurrection. People don't want to believe that because it would rot their world for obvious reasons. But basically, the question is not, do we believe in the supernatural? The question is, did this particular person rise from the dead? What do you think? I trained as a lawyer, so for me this is comparatively straightforward. I don't even need all the details to stack up, to be really honest. If I'm looking at a crash between two cars, and we've got various witnesses, and one of them says there was a blue car and a black car, and somebody says there were two blue cars, and somebody else says there were two dark colour cars, I know there was a car crash, right? It's really simple. The details of it don't really matter to me that much. So basically, it is definitely true that the people who write the Gospels emphasise different things. They emphasise different stories. They have their own material about Jesus. And all the details don't absolutely stack up, but still the main things do. They all talk about the resurrection. They all talk about the Jesus they saw, etc., etc. It's not my job to force people to believe something, especially not to convince people of something that's patently untrue. But if we are going to consider the meaning of life, it seems to me that we cannot ignore a man about whom it is claimed that death could not hold him. The ultimate statistic is this: each one of us here will die. One out of every one of us will die. Absolutely. If we are going to consider the meaning of life, how can we ignore a man whom death could not hold, who says he is the Lord of life? To me, it's a matter of common sense to take very seriously the teaching of anyone about life who's escaped from under the scythe of the grim reaper. It also makes no sense, with all due respect, to refuse to consider the evidence or engage with it on the grounds that dead men do not rise. Nobody here is saying that dead men rise. I am saying that one dead man rose. It's a historically particular claim based on evidence. It's not a general philosophical statement about faith or meaning or purpose, etc. or the supernatural. If you don't think the evidence supports the resurrection claim, good on you. Good on you. I'd be very interested to know what your alternative explanation for the empty tomb is, for the so-called resurrection appearances, for the change in the disciples, for the emergence and growth of the early church. I'd be interested to know what your alternative explanation is. I'd like to conclude by offering one more piece of undeniable evidence, whatever we make of it. This is undeniable evidence. It is 2,000 years worth of stories of apparently the risen Jesus still at work in the world. I thought about bringing about 20 books from my library, but I just couldn't be bothered. Anyway, these are sample representatives. This is a story of a Muslim woman who was paralyzed. Her father was an imam, and basically they spent money on doctors. They'd done the spiritual stuff. Nothing was working, and she stopped using the rote prayers of Islam and spoke to God in angriest possible terms and asked him to do something about her situation, at which point Jesus and the apostles apparently appear. She's completely healed. He tells her where to go to get a Bible. She follows the instructions, turns up outside a secret missionary's home, gets a Bible. This is Chasing the Dragon, the story of Jackie Pullinger. This is a 19-year-old girl who ignores all advice about not going and being a missionary at her age, rather foolishly probably, gets on a boat. God, where do you want me to get off? Oh, the walled city of Hong Kong. Okay. I have no money. I have 100 Hong Kong dollars. So I'm going to go there, etc. It's unpoliced because it's too violent and dangerous. To this day, she's still there. What she does is she finds heroin addicts, and she does the extraordinarily difficult thing of praying for them. And they come off drugs with nothing else except her praying for them. This has been so effective so many times, the Chinese government now sponsors it. Now, the problem is this. They could be lying to you, and so could all the other people who've written books about, often really quite badly, but they've written books about their amazing experiences. And there are like hundreds of thousands of them. Well, what do they all do? Are they all lying to you through their teeth? Every single one of them? See, this is the problem. Beginning with the book of Acts, in the New Testament, this isn't Jesus, this is his followers. So I'm just summarizing. The miraculous is around every corner. Peter and John heal a man who's been lame from birth, apparently. Peter heals a man suffering from palsy for 8 years. Peter has a miraculous escape from prison. His chains fall off, gates are opened by themselves, and he walks out unharmed. Peter raises a woman called Tabitha from dead. Paul heals a man crippled from birth. Paul also raises somebody from the dead, a man called Eutychus, who's been listening to him speak for too long, falls out of a window, and he has to go down and save his life. Paul has a miraculous escape from prison. It goes on. St. Augustine, one of the greatest brains of human history, wrote a well-known book called The City of God and includes a chapter's worth of miracles he has seen, including the healing of a man called Innocentius, ex-advocate of the deputy prefecture at Carthage, no less, who suffered from fistulae, of which apparently had a very large number intricately seated in his rectum. Now, I don't know what fistulae are. I don't want to know, but it sounds incredibly painful. Anyway, Augustine witnessed Innocentius being healed, and also a devout, high-ranking state official in the same city being healed of cancer, a doctor healed of gout, a comedian healed of paralysis, and many others. There are 2,000 years' worth of these sorts of stories. Francis of Assisi. Make me a channel of thy peace. I bet you had to sing that at school. Anyway, in the medieval period, records how he prayed for a knight's son in the city of Toscalina, who'd been crippled from birth. In the sight of all, the boy rose, began to walk hither and thither around the house, and he heals a woman of blindness in Gubbio, and he heals a paralytic in Narni. And on and on and on and on and on and on. Brother Andrew, I like him. God's smuggler, as he's known. Brother Andrew, he just thought it was a nightmare that communist countries didn't have the Bible. It was illegal. So what he did was he just filled his car with Bibles in full view. It's an illegal book. He'd drive up to the checkpoint, and he'd pray that God would make the guards blind, and he'd just drive straight through and give people the Bibles. Did it for 10 years. Again and again. Well, how does that happen? I mean, seriously. You can read his account if you like. There are absolutely thousands of these things going on, all very, very difficult. And then there's people like me. Oh, no, I've got awful ones to tell you. Do you want to hear some really awful ones? I really do have some awful ones. You know, so, for example, I was emailing today a girl called Christina who came to this church. She's now in Thailand planting a church. And basically, she was a student here, and she was doing this course. She was at the top of a heart transplant list and seeing doctors all the time. And basically was part of the student group. Goes on the life course weekend, comes back, and she's having mini heart attacks, so very serious, and is prayed for in church that Sunday by her friends, and immediately feels something has changed. Goes to see the doctor on Monday. She always sees the doctor on Monday. A few tests, a few more tests, Now we start testing the equipment, sending her to other equipment, and it turns out she has literally nothing wrong with her heart at all, nothing. So she's gone from the top of the list to I do not need a heart transplant in any way. She's been completely well ever since. So the people here that will be able to confirm that, but I could hook you up if you want, so you could hear her tell you that story for herself. Now, that's quite a thing, isn't it? Because, I mean, we know about coincidence, don't we? Yes, coincidence happens. I pray for a car parking space and I get one. But think about the causal connection between somebody is dying from a heart problem to, oh, no heart problem. What about this one? Also in the student group. Ben, this is you were praying for this one, weren't you? So Anna, first time I met her, sitting over there, she was wearing a full body cast. And had an amazingly courageous attitude to her awful situation, which was she had dislocated a leg, and doctors, in relocating the leg, broke her spine in several places because she had brittle bone syndrome, which nobody knew, and they also fractured her pelvis. Anyway, so her choices are have an operation which will leave you in a wheelchair or die. Basically, those are the two options you've got. And basically, she was telling me about this, and she was prayed for by some enthusiastic students, and basically she goes from that to nothing wrong with her spine whatsoever, and absolutely nothing wrong with her pelvis. Now let's assume for a moment I'm not lying to you. What power do you think there is in a group of nice, but enthusiastic, nice, you know, students putting their hands on somebody and saying a few words? That's just a question. Anyway, now those are big ones, aren't they? But in reality, I guess I saw somebody who's blind in one eye get their sight back. That was incredible. And the problem is I could go on and on, on and on, on and on and on. Then I could sit down and we could get every Christian here to tell their best story. On and on and on and on and on. I saw no evidence for the supernatural whatsoever until I became a Christian. None. I had a go. I looked for it, tried the occult, nothing, absolutely nothing. Nothing in religion, nothing in church, nothing. And from the moment I became a Christian, I started seeing supernatural things happen all the time, all the time. So, again, I'm a nightmare because I have experiences like this. I can be in some kind of meeting, and I feel like God will show me particular conditions he wants to heal. Like, for example, there's somebody here going on a cycling holiday to France who's got genital problems. Now, that's quite specific, isn't it, as opposed to there's somebody here with a bad knee. So somebody sidled up to me and said, that was me. And they got healed. Genital problems need healing too. And let's not be prejudicial. Another time I felt God say, would you mind just saying, there's somebody here working in the railway industry and I just want you to stop trying to get into the railway industry. So I'm thinking, well, no, really? Anyway, so I said that because I've lost all shame after the genital word of knowledge. I just say it anyway. So I said this. 2 years later, this woman says to me, did you say that in this meeting? I said, yes. She said, well, I've been working in the rail industry for 10 years, and I've been made redundant, and I wanted to work in the rail industry, so I was doing everything I could to get back in the rail industry. And basically, I couldn't get back in the rail industry. And so I said to God, if you don't want me in the rail industry, you're going to have to show me very, very clearly you don't want me in the rail industry. So I said, you know, there's somebody working in the rail industry, and I think God is saying, just leave the rail industry. Anyway, so her friends had all been saying, you know, you should be a teacher. She didn't want to be a teacher, because when she was at school, she had a terrible time. But she said, I stand before you now as a qualified teacher, and it's amazing because I work with these kids, and they don't have a clue what they're doing in general, but I understand, because that's exactly how I was. It's an incredible act of God, I would say. And I could go on and on, on and on, on and on and on and on. The process by which we came here, we raised £3 million. It's easy to trot these figures off. £3 million with a congregation of 900 people, average age 25. You know, how do you do that? We just did quite a lot of praying. I received over 10 gifts of 100,000 from people, often people I didn't know. How does that happen? We're just praying, generally speaking. What does that mean? Oh, I sit in a room and I lie on my bed and I say a few words into the air. And there's 100,000. One guy ran me up and said, would you like to come on a cruise to the Caribbean and preach to my family? I'd like to give you $100,000 for your project. I said, do you want to know about the project? He said, no, number one rule of fundraising, John, never turn down money. And that's an important lesson there. I did go on the cruise to the Caribbean. And because he paid for everybody to be there, to troop into this room to hear me do these things. And several of them became Christians. And then we started a church. But I could go on and on and on. My only point is just to say there's something worth considering here, I suggest. Something worth considering. I may be a complete nutter, and all these people may be nutters as well, but there are a lot of us claiming this kind of thing, and we're not all mental. you know, I went to Oxford, I studied twice a law and a theology. I'm not mental, I don't think. You can have a go if you think I am, you know. But as far as I can see, I've met some mental people. I've met some mental people in church and outside church. As far as I can tell, let's have a look. Yep, comparatively normal. So, you know, what do you think? If this is true, there are some implications very quickly. The fullness of life. Jesus claims to be the fullness of life. So you have life, you're alive. Imagine being connected to the person who is life. So the fullness of life coursing through you, making you into the fullest expression of you you could possibly be. That's one implication. Jesus said, I've come to bring life in all its fullness. Then also death. There'd be no anxiety about dying, because when you die, you will be with him. I am the resurrection and the life, he says. Whoever believes in me will never die, even though they die. Again, the one thing we have in common is we're going to die. Except in Christ, we'll never die. It would mean knowing the true meaning of life, quite frankly. I am the way, the truth, and the life, he says. This is, of course, about meaning. It's about the existence of an overarching meaning and the possibility of that. It's about humanity's search for an overarching meaning. But the resurrection, if it happened, declares that Jesus is the meaning of life. That's only a taste of the implications. There are so many of them. From time to time on this course, I feel like I wouldn't be true to the thing if I didn't give people an opportunity to make a response to what I'm saying. So the easiest way of doing this, so as to respect people's dignity and to respect people who don't want to make any kind of response, I suggest, is that we just perhaps close our eyes or bow our heads so we're not looking at anybody else. I'm going to pray a prayer out loud. And if you want to make it your own, you can. If you don't want to, it's absolutely fine. But basically, this will be a prayer which says, okay, Jesus, if this is real, if this could even vaguely be real, here I am, beam me up, or whatever, you know, here I am, make it real to me. If this is true, just, you know, wherever I'm coming from, let me know. So this is you in your own heart saying, I don't know whether I believe in God or not, but if there is the possibility, I would like to know. So I will lead us in a prayer of that kind if you want to pray it. If you don't want to pray it, once again, there's no pressure on you to do so. Maybe we could close our eyes for a moment. And you will know if this is the kind of thing you want to pray. Could this possibly be true? Despite everything, could you be the one person who's come in search of me? Could you be real? Could these things I'm hearing be true? Are you there to speak to? If there is any possibility, I open myself to you. If you have been raised from the dead, you can surely convince me. Amen. Cool. Thank you. Caffeine and stuff are being served now. And next week we go on to consider how we can actually make a connection with this Jesus.